All right. Well, thanks to everybody for coming out. Welcome to Sundays at the Modern. As you know, this is an artist, art historian, architect, scholar-led tour series. We meet at 1 o'clock on every Sunday afternoon, some holidays excluded. It is my great pleasure to introduce you to your speaker today, artist Rebecca Carter. She earned her BA in studio art, art history, and women's studies at Oberlin College, went on to earn her BFA from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, and then her MFA in fiber and material studies from the same institution. She's earned grants and fellowships, including the 1993 Mellon Grant, the 2006 and 2007 Meadows School of Art Research and Travel Grant, and the 2008 Meadows Summer Fellowship. She's also held residencies, including Catwalk at Catskill in New York, Vermont Studio Center in Johnson, Vermont, and most recently, the Why Not Place in New Delhi, India. She's currently a member of the 500X Gallery over in Dallas, and you might have seen her work in last month's member show. You might also have seen her work in shows like the 2006 New American Talent Exhibition at Art House down in Austin. In 2007, she was included in Deconstruction Site 1 at the Corcoran Museum in Washington, D.C. In 2009, she participated in Partial Moon, the Cheongju International Craft Biennale in the Republic of Korea. And then earlier this year, a solo exhibition at Eastfield College called Friendliness Towards All Things, and then Saudade, the transforming state at Arts Religare in New Delhi, India. Please join me in welcoming Rebecca Carter.
Hello. There we go. Okay. Okay, great. So, yes, I'm Rebecca Carter, and this is a really great opportunity. I think one of the things I really love about the Modern is the Department of Education, which actually really supports the local artists. And for me, this is an opportunity, or was an opportunity, to come in and look at the look at the collection in kind of a wholly different way. And I actually made the decision that I was going to make very intuitive, not knowing, not premeditated decisions about what I wanted to talk about. So with the idea that moving through a state of not knowing, which is like Keats talks about this as a really productive, rich, fertile state, the state of negative capability, which is to be able to be in the middle of doubts and uncertainties without any irrational grasping after fact and reason. So this is, some people are nodding their heads like, you know this is really familiar. Some people are giving me funny little smiles like, I don't know what you're talking about. So there's some things I'm going to talk about that I haven't really thought a whole lot about until fairly recently, including the piece that I'm going to start with, which is the Ben Shahn allegory piece. So I'm kind of curious, who are you guys? Like, how many people come to the museum more than once a month? Okay, so you're maybe a docent. Okay. And then how many people, this is the first time you've ever been to the Fort Worth Modern? Okay, and you're maybe from out of town? Yeah. And do you go to art museums a lot? Yeah. And then the rest of you guys are? Yeah, okay. Studied art. Come often. Okay. Good. So, a little bit about my own practice as an artist. I work right now. I've been working for the past couple of years with a textile process that I call the groundless thread drawing, and I've been appropriating a lot of text images from the world around me, and then reiterating them through a process of projecting, redrawing, tracing, stitching, dissolving, peeling apart, and then pinning up to a wall. So I'm taking things that exist and then pulling them through several material transformations. So some of my interests, sort of unabiding interests, include drawing, drawing, an interest in materiality, an interest in performativity. And most recently in India, I just did a project where I was thinking about reading the visual. I was trying to map a process of going from complete unknowing of a place, unfamiliarity, to a process of building habit. So I was there for 6 weeks. Four of them I was in a residency where I would essentially every day do the same thing over and over again. And I was thinking a lot about a trip that I took several years ago to Brazil, where I had the experience of being lost. I stayed with a friend who lived in a neighborhood where, to me, all the buildings looked so unfamiliar that I couldn't pick out one from the other. And so I would take these walks and think, oh, for sure, I will be able to get back to my, you know, this is easy. You know, I wouldn't really even think twice about it necessarily, but I would leave the house and then I would realize, oh, I don't even remember what the house looked like because all these houses look so different. So it's like within that, then slowly there's a process of building a pattern of habit so that things become sort of second nature and almost just second nature, I guess. So both of those are kind of these funny states of not really knowing, actually. The first being not knowing because sort of being overwhelmed by the difference of things, and then the second, not knowing in the sense of a routine takes over and takes over the process. So I'm interested in that kind of, like, these really kind of subtle kind of awarenesses of attention, mindfulness, the process of learning, the question of whether, how do you learn something, like the idea of paranoia, the idea that we only can learn things from the world that we already have some kind of relationship to. So when we, I mean, and that's the sort of idea of the getting lost in the architecture in Brazil, is this, that I did, was unfamiliar, and so therefore I couldn't sort of get a grasp of it. But it's a sort of an issue, or a bigger issue if you're trying to create a transformation of consciousness in the world around you. How do you do that if people's experiences is continually being filtered by what they already know? How do you create a new experience? How do you create a moment of creativity? How do you create a moment of sort of transcending? It's a really, to me, that's a kind of complicated question. So let's go in to the gallery.
Uncertainty, because you really are struggling with your old preconceived ideas, and then you're looking for new ideas. Is that what I'm interpreting?
So say that again.
You're saying that you are looking for this unknown region, but at the same time you are looking for that unknown. We all have built preconceived ideas. So how do you struggle with that?
Yeah, so, okay. I'm not sure.
Because, I mean, we all come with preconceived ideas. So when you go to this unknown world, you know, you have a package already.
How do you navigate what you know and something new? Yeah, I think, that's a question. Yeah. I mean, I was talking about that idea of even literally navigating in the city. Yeah. So, the other thing I've been thinking about as preparing for this talk is my relationship to schools and museums. I went to two schools that actually have really, really amazing museums, and one is the Oberlin Museum of Art. It's a beautiful little comprehensive museum that actually has a really strong collection, small but strong collection of contemporary art, which was really, I think, built under the auspices of Ellen Johnson, who was an art historian there for several years. And there's a beautiful Alice Neal portrait of Ellen Johnson as part of that little permanent collection. And I also had in that collection, I got exposed to works like Cindy Sherman, some of the earlier film stills, both black and white and the color. There's also a really beautiful, a really amazing Eva Hesse sculpture. Eva Hesse's Loakawan is also housed at the Oberlin Museum of Art, and several other things. But the other thing that the Oberlin Museum had was a program of where students could borrow works of art for the semester. So it was like a lending library of works of art and works of some very, very famous artists and some maybe less famous artists. So that was something that I participated in and my friends participated in, and you know, got mostly small works on paper, but that you could live with in your home. So and then at the School of the Art Institute, of course, is also amazing. The Art Institute of Chicago is a really incredible museum, sort of overwhelming in scale compared to something like the Fort Worth Modern, which has got a kind of tighter focus. So I think the other thing I'm going to start with are a couple of readings. And the first one is a poet that I've been re-looking at recently, Elizabeth Bishop, who is a modern American poet, I think one of the most strong, important poets of the last century. And she also spent a long time in Brazil. She spent a chunk of time in Brazil, and she writes these very kind of poignant, everyday narratives about the experience of being lost or not lost exactly, but sort of this kind of nostalgia or homelessness but the poem I'm going to read to you is one you may be familiar with because it's one of her most famous poems, but I've been thinking about it also in terms of thinking about the works in the museum, and it's called One Art. So the art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost, that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hour badly spent. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing further, losing faster. Places and names, where it was you meant to travel, none of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch, and look, my last or next to last of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I missed them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident. The art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. So that's the Elizabeth Bishop, which to me is a familiar text, and I think in contemporary art, one of the things that happens is this continual losing over and over and over again of various different things. Artists losing color, losing kind of realistic drawing, losing I don't know, there's just kind of the more and more focus you get, losing a whole range of materials and focusing onto a material, this kind of process of disintegration and losing. So that's number one reading. And are you ready for number two? Number two is a is from a writer that I have been reading in the past 2 years. She's a very dense writer. She's a psychoanalyst working in the tradition of sort of working through Freud and through Lacan, but with the intention to theorize the space of the feminine, so which is something that that Freud and Lacan both themselves knew was missing from their work, and what they were working on was so big, it sort of just remained an ellipsis. So she's a Israeli artist. She's an artist, she's a painter, she's a psychoanalyst, and she's also a writer of theory and a contributor to the tradition of theory. And this is a book that's been published of her work. It's called The Matrixial Border Space. And this is she's not very widely read in the United States, and I'm trying to remember where I came across her work, but I think it was doing Google searches. But in Europe and in London, in England in particular, there's a kind of a bigger discourse around her work. And she's sort of been foregrounded by the art historian Griselda Pollack, who some of you will be familiar with as a kind of grande dame in the art of art history, feminist art history. And then in this book also there's a foreword by Judith Butler. So Judith Butler, who's studied Hegel and is a theorist on issues of gender and queer identity. So Judith Butler is also sort of engaged in this practice. And then also Brian Masumi, who was the translator of, who's a professor of contemporary literary, but also translated Deleuze and Guattari's books, Anti-Oedipus and A Thousand Plateaus. So those are two other books that have been, that are very dense also, and but have been really important to me. In Bracca's and Ettinger's work, she has sort of articulated this new a phrase that she calls the matrixial, and she posits the matrixial in relationship to the phallic. So the phallic is sort of the thing we're most, the phallic identity is the thing we're most familiar, well, we're probably not that familiar with psychoanalytic theory, but a phallic identity is built on the process of cutting away from cutting. So this idea, like, also of loss and separating. Yeah, I've lost. It's okay. So a phallic identity is built on differentiating from, separating from, being autonomous from, eliminating your ties to, in particular, the mother. So the mother, life begins, that's a question, but the matrixial is sort of based on the corporeal experience of the mother with the baby inside the womb, which is an experience of two beings who are, I've never been a mother, but two beings who are coming into identity at the same time, but as strangers. They don't know each other yet, so the mother and the baby, and they're literally physically connected and psychically connected, and yet they are strangers from each other. So this is, this is a little section. Okay. So, she's also doing a lot of, as an artist and a psychoanalyst, she's doing work on thinking about how art operates and how art functions. And there's this idea of the matrixial border space, which is a space in which, similarly to the mother and the baby, the artist is a stranger to the viewer of the work, but somehow the artist has a relationship to the work and imbues the work with certain kinds of traces of both personal and archaic history, so both direct experience and also experiences that are sort of beyond consciousness. So, and then the idea is that then the viewer might come to experience the work, and somehow, unbeknownst to them, certain things are translated through the work to the experiencer of the work. So this is a kind of a really complex idea, and I really came to it through an experience that I had of, I know this is of Agnes Martin's work and seeing an exhibition of Agnes Martin's work and having, this was in 1993, before I had ever really studied art history, and having the experience of that work just completely overwhelming me with an incredible sense of transcendent joy that I couldn't explain, and I couldn't understand how it was at all possible that these kind of totally mundane, barely anything at all paintings of lines could create such an incredible emotional and it wasn't, it's not just an emotional affect, it's an affect or experience that was physical and also of the mind, but also an emotional experience. So it was a complex, fully. Are you guys familiar with Agnes Martin's work? Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. You know some. Okay. So I mean, if you look at those paintings, and they're just nothing. You know, like they're almost just gray, white, and then there are these little, teeny, thin pencil lines that just sort of go well in certain bodies of the work. So. One of my first exposures to Ettinger was an essay that she wrote for an exhibition at the Drawing Center that Catherine de Zagar, who was a curator there, curated, called Three Times Abstraction. It was three women artists, Emma Kuntz, A.F. Klimt, and Agnes Martin. So there's an essay that Ettinger wrote giving an aesthetic theoretical explanation of what that experience, basically, I think, of what that experience that I had was. So, okay, so I'm going to just read you this so you get a feeling for her, the way that she writes, which is relies a lot on rhythm and creating a new kind of language. And it's processing traumatic events of and for the other. So this is all about a relationship between beings. And this idea of trauma, which by definition, in psychoanalytic terms, a trauma is an experience that you have that you can't articulate to yourself, that you don't have the language to articulate. So in essence, my experience of Agnes Martin's work was a traumatic experience because it was a full-on, full-fledged experience, but that I couldn't, I didn't understand how to articulate what happened or what it was that happened. Also, I would say that the experience of being born, just sort of the fundamental experience of being a human being in the world, is an experience of trauma because it is something completely uncognized. We don't understand it, but we experience it, and we sort of spend our... Well, some people are more interested in these kinds of questions than others, but these are questions that I'm interested in my own work. So traces circulate in a trans-subjective zone. So trans-subjective means a zone that is shared by several different subjects at the same time. By way of matrixial affects, and affects have to do with the physical experience of emotional qualities, or sort of like the physical aspect of emotion, and non-conscious threads that disperse different aspects of virtual and traumatic events between I and non-I, so me and what's not me. And me and not me could be me and someone else. It could be me and the work of art. It could be me and some part of myself that my ego is not identifying as me. So me, I, and non-I. So that's a phrase that comes up over and over and again in her work. Okay, since I cannot fully handle events that profoundly concern me. So this is the idea of trauma, like things that happen that are unable to be articulated, unable to be... I mean, perhaps the process of falling in love could be this kind of experience too. This kind of like something that is unarticulatable, but happens in a full-on physical experience. Okay. Since I cannot fully handle events that profoundly concern me, they fade in transformation, while my non-I becomes witness to them. And then this is another word that she's creating: withness. Mm-hmm. So a witness, becoming witness, but also with. This kind of idea of being together with, opening up a space where two beings share a space. Okay, so withness to them. It may happen that because of my premature subjectivity or the highly traumatic value of the events, I cannot psychically handle my encounters at all. In the matrixial psychic sphere, my imprints will be transcribed in the other, and to begin with, in the M mother. So she is. She has this other construction, which is little M slash big O T H E R. So the which, of course, relates to the idea of the mother as sort of like the first other, the first other that the baby experiences, and then the big O other, which is in psychoanalytic thought this. A kind of transcendent other, this big, the big O other. It's not just me and you, but it's the big O other. Okay, so within, okay, transcribed in the other, and to begin with in the a mother. Thus, my others will process traumatic events for me like my a mother processed archaic events for my premature and fragile subjectivity. So this is the idea of, you know, this, humans have this really long process of coming into being, really a slow process of coming into having the capacity to have a subjectivity, to say I am, I know, I do, and in the meantime, the mother, and of course the father, it's not that the father is not a part of this, the father is also an a mother in certain ways, it's not necessarily tied to a biological idea of gender. Of course, in psychoanalytic theory, all of that, there are these things are tied to biology, but also conceived of as kind of conceptual structures. So like that, my mother processed archaic events for my premature and fragile subjectivity. So, and this is one of the things that she talks about is the idea of. I mean, this is one of the things. Well, I'm going to leave that aside. Okay. So female bodily specificity is thus the site, psychically, imaginatively, and symbolically, where a feminine difference emerges and through which a, quote, woman is interlaced as a figure that is not confined to one body, but is rather a hybrid webbing, quote, of links between several subjectivities. So this is getting into the idea of the matrixial as several subjectivities linked in this trans-subjective sphere that is perhaps conscious and perhaps not conscious. So one of the ways I think, so we're gonna, like, I'm thinking about this in relationship to art, but this is also sort of the experience of the transfer of emotional content that happens in a, you know, if you walk into a room and you feel the energy in the room, that is something that has not been communicated to you through a verbal language, or it may not even happen in a particularly conscious visual language, but you feel it. There's something that happens. You're picking up on traces of things that have happened before you that are then in turn related to all kinds of other traces. Okay. So this idea of a woman as an interlaced, as a figure that is not confined to one body, but rather is a hybrid webbing of links between several subjectivities, who by virtue of that webbing become partial. So this is, again, in contrast to the idea of the phallic identity, which is the authority, the one that stands up and knows, the one that is separate from mother, separate from father, you know, kills the father. So this is a really different idea of what subjectivity is. And this is, I also became interested in this work during the time when I was doing a lot of teaching and I was experiencing my role as a teacher as being one of holding a kind of space for my students and a kind of creating space for their different subjectivities to kind of co-emerge. And I think it was a different kind of teaching than I experienced in many other teachers who kind of hold a position of really strong authority and sort of expound and dictate. And right now I'm kind of doing a teeny bit of that because I'm just talking at you, which is interesting. I often, when I'm in the museum with people, have a lot of dialogue and interaction. So, okay. So rather a hybrid webbing of links between several subjectivities who by virtue of that webbing become partial. So what is it also to be a partial identity? It's a confused and complicated kind of place, existence. So in this idea of processing the trauma of the other, there's this idea of becoming partial I, in relationship to the non-I, and that in that state there's a moment that could be a potentially very healing possibility. So it could be an experience where you feel a sense of wholeness restored to yourself, or a creative move in a new direction, or it could also be re-traumatizing because the state of being vulnerable is, you know, like at the end of this talk, maybe I will be re-traumatized, or potentially, hopefully, I will return to a state of a new wholeness, a new kind of understanding of these kind of things. And this is the first time I've really tried to share this information, and I'm doing it in a kind of just partial way. But okay, so metamorphosis, and this is another one of her phrases, metamorphosis as a carrier of originary difference and its transforming potentiality includes instances of co-emergence and co-fading as meaning and of transcription as the memory of oblivion. So metamorphosis is also metra is a word that comes from the womb, the metra, the matrix. So metamorphosis is a process of transformation, and metamorphosis is this process of transformation that happens in this trans-subjective state. Yeah. So. With the other eyes. Yeah. Okay. So, as the memory of oblivion, and of course, oblivion—that's the kind of state before which we come into being, or it could be a state of being drunk, or it could be the state of being asleep. So, oblivion is a state of not knowing.
Could it be the state just before we began to interact with a work of art? Is that oblivion?
That's an interesting question. I think when we stand in front of a work of art, we could be in a state of oblivion, yeah. Okay, so in the matrixial border space, a specific aesthetic field with ethical implications comes to light with metamorphosis as a poetic artistic process. Okay, so All of that. To give you, I think, a sense of, there are a lot of things going on beyond the visual. And, we're in a visual art museum, and this is a talk about visual art. But I think through also this, and that's just a little bit of a beginning, but through this idea, there's also a way of thinking about art that is separated from whether it is realist or non-realist, objective or non-objective, what materials it's made out of. It's a way of thinking. Because these kinds of this kind of information enters into art regardless of its style. So we can look at a Ben Shahn painting here, which is semi-realistic. We understand that this is a figure, a beast, a big chimera lion with little figures down here, and there's some woods and forest down here, and then there's various kind of things that that have been covered up and disappeared in the background, and we can look at that and think about these kinds of ideas in the same way we can think about them in relationship to the Jackson Pollock drawing right here, which is a completely different kind of idea of what painting is, like completely different. So Ben Shahn, do you know Ben Shahn's work much? Ben Shahn spent a chunk of his life working as a WPA photographer. So he was photographing in kind of rural states in the United States, and kind of had a love for people and story and kind of the vernacular. And then he made gazillions and gazillions and gazillions of these really wonderful kind of simple line drawings where he was sort of processing that kind of information. And then this is a painting that he talks about in depth. If you're interested in reading about it, there's an essay called, The Birth of a Painting. With the birth of a painting, it's in his book, *The Shape of Content*, and he talks about where this painting comes from, and he talks about it in response to a critic who has criticized him and said that this is all about Red Russia, and he goes into the painting and he talks about what's visually there, which is this sort of fiery lion, and then he says, right immediately, I was processing this a Chicago fire in Chicago where several people had lost their home and were kind of traumatized, and he had been taking photographs of that, and then he started making drawings. And then he said, but then what I realized is that this fire reminded me of two fires that I experienced as a kid. So I experienced, you know, and one was a really devastating fire, and then one was a sort of a, more like an explosion fire. So, and then he goes on and on and on to make other kinds of different associations to the painting. Yeah. Yeah.
Saw this painting was that this was a mother and protecting children, mm-hmm. but obviously on closer examination that is not true. But is there something nurturing about the very male lion that you see?
That's funny because I think of the lion as a she lion. But I guess it has a phallus, doesn't it? Yeah. But I guess I've been looking at the Romulus and Remus, the twins suckling on Romulus. And, so, yeah, that it's protective and that it's kind of like overarching. Yeah, so that's an interesting idea, the trauma of the fire being connected to a nurturing kind of... but it's, yeah, the lion is not very aggressive, is it? I mean, it sort of has a sort of soft, open face. Yeah, I think I read it also the face, that the kind of openness of the face of the lion, the way the eyes, that we could almost pass through that face. But it's also, it's a funny tension actually, because this also looks like a pile of dead people. No. Yeah. Yeah,
of how he responded to that, this quote unquote interpretation.
And what's the misinterpretation?
As being interpreted as Russia.
Well, I know, but the funny thing is that he, at the same time as he's making this argument against that, this is an argument that's about the politics of that, time and the idea of communism. And the truth is, the lion is related to Russia and to his experience Lithuanian who left. So, I mean, and he literally talks about these experiences from his childhood, which are in that. So he does, it's kind of actually a funny thing because he is making these arguments against, but then he also kind of reconfirm certain kinds of things.
The exhibition upstairs where the artist is giving you all of these supposedly disparate elements that you're welcome to make associations with, but when you talk to the artist, he really has he has some ideas about how you will do that. Or you can suggest that maybe he was thinking about something and he'll say, no, I never heard of that. But in fact, we know that he's very well read and he watches a lot of films, so that was probably in there. In other words, you never speak from a single perspective, which seems to be what you were alluding to with some of your reading.
Right, and the the artist is both the authority and not the authority on their work and can't always actually read what is actually there.
Not fully.
Yeah. Your reaction, this idea of and the vulnerability of being, of having ourselves exposed or reflected. I think, say the beginning part of that again. I do think that's true. I haven't really thought about it a whole lot. Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about the Pollock too. So. So this piece. So now I guess we make kind of like a leap from this kind of something that's maybe tied more to the history of representational painting to something that breaks that all together, and the idea that Pollock, I mean, this is a really represents a kind of radical moment because Pollock is the whole kind of ideas about no longer trying to depict a story or a narrative, you know, which Benchon, you know, and these are almost contemporaries. These are, almost happening at the same time. And the truth is, I think, when I look at I've never really thought a lot about the Benchon because it's sort of outside of the kind of history of art that I have considered to be these kind of major breaking points. And in a way, although he was a very, well-sold artist, I don't think he's really talked about as a major figure in the sort of history of art or the kind of junctures of the transition of art. I think he was very beloved. Tell me if I'm... Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. So this idea of getting out of showing something, but then making the whole act of painting be an act of engaging in a certain kind of space, a kind of interior space and literally the physical space because he put the canvas down on the ground. And if you watch the paint, the especially the first film of... Do I need this?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. No, I don't. So, I don't know. I love this draw. This is a drawing that I particularly love because it. I really like drawing. I think for me, I think this is kind of is a little, like a very big Pollock painting is very overwhelming and a very intense experience and kind of like a it's a completely overwhelming experience, and this is like a little fragment. It's a drawing. It's a little kind of moment of that kind of process. And I think back to the images, the Hans Nemeth film of Pollock painting, and I think the memory of Pollock is, or the idea of Pollock is, as someone who is very aggressive and kind of wild, and like the story of him hanging out in the bar with his friends, and that he would make this gesture and take the other person's glass and just subtly kind of turn it to the side as a way of asserting a kind of aggressive dominance over the person in the room. But if you watch him painting, there's a very kind of soft and attentive and mindful way in which he's actually moving that paint across the canvas. Yeah, so you make associations to other things. Yeah, I think I make associations to the movement, to the physical state, to the kind of, like I guess, like I said, like the film. And I also, I love the Pollock for the materiality, for his relationship to paint, and this kind of making paint into this fluid, liquid, thread-like kind of substance, where he's literally dragging the thread across the canvas. Yeah, there are all these associations made between Pollock and the sand painters, and Pollock and the mural painters, and I think that's in there. And these idea of galaxies, this was another thing that was really talked about, outer space, this kind of changing ideas about what space is, which is a, you know, but gets back to the Brucke end, or this idea of space and a transsubjective space, or a different kind of space than what have been familiar with already. So where are we? Let's move on. I'm sorry.
Only 13 years from the...
This I know. Yeah, Pollock... Yeah. All right, so now we're in a completely again other world, which is Felix Gonzalez Torres. This piece is untitled LA. And are you familiar with Felix Gonzalez Torres? Yeah, okay. So help yourself to a candy. Work that sometimes exists in three places at one time here in Dallas, because it's sometimes installed at the Rachofsky House, sometimes installed at the DMA, and also here. And it's this configuration of it is actually really strange to me because of the sort of irregular kind of water-like shape. I've normally thought about the Felix Gonzalez Torres as these pieces as being much more sort of geometric and installed in relationship to the architecture in a really different way, and I'm not sure what the thought is behind this, but this is again a huge leap from the idea of Pollock being a place to perform, and then all of a sudden in this we literally perform with the piece by taking the candy and sucking on it, and the. To Torres. The most famous of the candy pieces is one called Ross's Ideal Weight, and Felix Gonzalez Torres was a gay man who had a lover who died of AIDS before he died, and these candy pieces were originally this idea of this. So the first one was Ross's ideal weight. So Ross before he got sick with the you participate. We come into the room, take a piece of candy, and then by doing that, we get this sort of small thrill of experiencing the candy. But then we also are participating in the dissolution of the piece. The piece dissolves into our physical, literally into our physical bodies. And then the various other transformations that it makes from there. So there's kind of a poignancy in that. And then also a question of what is art, you know, like again, a question of what is the art or where is the art. And these pieces are, if you don't know, they're installed, participated in and then reinstalled, and they exist more as contracts, like literally like contracts. Does anybody have any questions? I feel like this is sort of dissolved, like a piece of candy. I feel like I Yeah, well, I think of Felix Gonzalez Torres like in relationship to his relationship to conceptual art and minimalism, and then to see this kind of spread out and like this is just a little bit different. I also been thinking about this in relationship to Pollock painting on the floor. I mean that this is like a floor, a scatter floor piece that is asked to be enacted by the people who work in the museum or the people that own the piece. So sort of reinserting the bodies of others while deinserting the kind of physical presence of the artist, the hand of the artist. Yeah. Yes, I think absolutely that would be a way to think about this piece. Right, and that it existed and then it becomes again. And becomes again. Yeah. Yeah, but the memory is only permanent in so long as it is remembered by somebody. Yeah. Yeah, this piece isn't necessarily connected to Ross, but it's connected to that other, to the other piece. But the color is really important. It is, the color in the Ross pieces is kind of like a confetti of primary colors, shiny, within the shiny wrappers. But I think also that, I mean, this idea of memory and traces goes back to this, to the Bracket Enter, and this idea that actually we have no idea what the kinds of traces are being left, because things circulate and translate and become something different. And that maybe that's a little bit what you're talking about. Right, and that goes back to the idea of seeing what you already know. So, like, we're going to look at this and we see it as a river because it relates to the shape of a river and we're familiar with a river. And it is a river, and it's extending out into the water. Water like a river, yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a really beautiful kind of association to what I started with. Yeah, or with the Bracket Enter, or the kind of connection to the stranger and the co-emergence and co-fading in indifference with the stranger. Okay, so we could do. I want to talk about the John Chamberlain too. So let's go. Yeah, so this is a piece by Chamberlain who I have come to. I think the process of coming to art is a slow and gradual process of coming into, like coming into being or coming into being as a subject who knows things. But the title of this piece is Skull's Angel, and it connects to a guy who had a taxi fleet in New York, so a wealthy man in New York who actually supported the gallery where this was sold. And I, like, when you read John Chamberlain talk about his process of making the work, it's sort of like this very helter-skelter. At the beginning, it was sort of like a random idea, okay, this is a material that's available, and somehow I'm really excited about how I can think about fitting it together, crushing it, crumpling it, smushing it, making it connect. I don't think I really got John Chamberlain's piece until the second time I was in Marfa at the installation of the Chinati Foundation of the really large Chamberlain pieces. And I all of a sudden, I had been driving out there, I had been reading Jane Jacobs, who is an urban planner who wrote a book about wrote a lot about the automobile and about kind of politics around the automobile. And literally driving out to Marfa is this really long 8-hour drive where you, for me as a foreigner to Texas, it's a real experience of the automobile, of the road, and of literally seeing the oil wells and thinking about Texas as a site of the automobile. And then arriving, and then also And then what John Chamberlain has done with the car parts is made them so light and so airy and so dynamic and so full of this completely other life than cars on a road. And then a second time where I've really, really thought about John Chamberlain was, I don't know if you've ever been to a junkyard like in Grand Prairie here in Texas. There are these. Recently, I needed to go to a junkyard, and you go walk into these places, and they're just piles and piles and piles and piles of automobiles neatly organized, piled on top of each other. And there's an incredible feeling of, it was almost terrorizing because how did these cars get here, and the automobile accidents that happened to bring the cars here, and like, what was I doing trying? And then the way that the cars become unidentifiable. Like, I drive a pretty common car, a Toyota, and I realized I couldn't tell the Toyotas from the Nissans from the Mazda, because everything has lost its sort of traces. And then the other thing about these pieces is they are so tied to the time. I mean, this was not like things that Chamberlain was thinking about, but cars aren't made out of this kind of metal anymore. I mean, this kind of metal doesn't. A lot of it would be plastic, and it's just not as heavy. It's just not as substantial, and it's a whole different kind of sense of space. And I think for Chamberlain, he seemed to be just completely fascinated with the idea of how to make things fit together, how to squish, how to mush, how to like find just the right kind of relationship, which is really different than the kind of way of working of Felix Gonzalez Torres, which is this kind of really kind of cool, separated, conceptual approach that's actually dealing with these really intense emotional issues. But then in related, like, people talk about this as sort of this sculptural extension of abstract expressionism, which it sort of is, but it's also working with something so physical and solid is so much slower. It's such a different kind of like sense of perception. So how that relates to the matrixial border space, I'm not sure. These are things I really want to think about now, actually. And is this deconstruction? Deconstruction of what? Of a car. Yeah, I don't know if I would call that a deconstruction, but it is a right. It was meant to be useful, productive. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a really nice way to think about these pieces, I think, actually. Well, yeah, I think you're right. That's like this angle right here. And then like a kind of sense of spiral, things are kind of crumpled in around themselves. Yeah, I mean, that's to me one of the most poignant things about these pieces, actually, is their just factual connection to that moment in time. And then an artist took that material and did so much with it. Yeah, and that won't be impossible to recreate, or it would be something completely and entirely different. Yeah. All right, I think maybe we've done enough for today. So thanks. Yeah, you're welcome.